Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly roundup of Utah news featuring reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. Today on the program, some Democrats and unaffiliated voters have been switching their registration to Republican to participate in the GOP primary elections. How much of a difference might that actually make? A Utah dancer comes forward with a story of online harassment by a local choreographer, prompting a flood of Me Too responses. And the underlying issues in the beauty industry that perpetuate hair discrimination for Black Utahns. Those and other stories on the docket today. And joining me for this conversation, both in studio this morning, we've got Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Kim Bohorquez. And good morning, Kim. Great to have you here.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. And Robert Gerke, good morning to you. Thanks for being here.
Hola.
Hola, buenos dias. A ti también. Okay, so let's see. Listeners, you can join this conversation. A little bit later in the show, we are going to hear from Palak Jaiswal on some reporting of hers that has to do with culture. She's the culture reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can name check us on Twitter. Our handle is at KCPW. And Pat Bagley had a cartoon this week depicting a Trojan elephant, a gift to the Utah GOP from Democrats. And that is where we're going to start today, is with the idea of party raiding. And this is something that is not all that new, Kim Bohorquez, but let's explain what's happening here and the strategy behind it. What is party raiding in the Utah context in the year 2022?
Yeah, so party raiding, you know, it's sometimes called that. It's also called party switching. And it's a political tactic used by some people ahead of a primary election, especially if that so in this case, the Republican Party has closed primaries. You know, you need to be registered to vote as a Republican. And this is a political tactic that we saw during the the gubernatorial race in 2020, you know, we saw independents, we saw Democrats switch their party affiliation in order to participate in the Republican primaries, you know, to have a say or to have some type of sway to see who won the government race, the governor race. And this year, we're seeing it as the June Republican primaries approach. You know, we just passed a deadline on March 31st. It was yesterday for you know, anyone to be able to change their party registration.
Mm. Your story kicks off with a gentleman named Trevor Warburton, who signed up recently as a Republican because he's concerned about, you know, who is getting through the Republican primaries, as you just pointed out, that the primaries are kind of the focus of a lot of people who are doing this this party switching. Is that correct to say that the primary itself is more important to these people than say just joining the Republican Party? It's about influencing who gets through to the November election.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Democrats, you know, haven't been really successful in elections, in winning elections here in Utah, and you know, some people believe that if they switch parties, if they participate in the primary, that they can have a sway in or an influence in who makes it on the November ballot. Hmm.
Isn't there a kind of newish law on the books to try to curb this practice, Kim?
Yeah, so, you know, as I said before, a lot of people did this during the governor's race in 2020, and lawmakers passed a law that required that if somebody wanted to switch their party affiliation ahead of a primary, it needed to be 3 months before, which is why, you know, we're probably seeing a few voters change their party affiliation before March 31st.
And that law was in direct response to what happened in the gubernatorial primary?
I mean, yes.
Interesting. there's a difference, as you said, I mean, between the parties on who gets to vote in which primary. And so maybe you can explain about that. You said that the Republicans have a closed primary, Democrats have an open primary, but what does that actually mean? I mean, if I, as somebody who's unaffiliated, wants to vote in either of those two primaries, can I?
If you're an unaffiliated voter, so it's not just, you know, I would actually say that it's more unaffiliated voters who are switching to Republican races.
Yeah.
You need to be a registered Republican to participate in a primary election, you know, in the Republican one. And, you know, Princeton Princeton researchers actually analyzed voter data from 2020, and they found that most people who were party switching were unaffiliated voters. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't necessarily because they wanted to do party raiding. It wasn't because they wanted to, you know, game the system, as some Republicans have said. But they say that it's because what drew them to do that is competitive races. And in 2020, you know, the governor's race was extremely competitive and tight.
Right. Okay. So that it wasn't necessarily so the law was in response to what happened in 2020. Princeton researchers say this is actually less about the problem that you imagine is there. But there is obviously a concerted movement, because you spoke with these people who are doing this now. What do the two major parties say about what's happening here? I mean, you reached out to the Republican Party, I know, and the Democratic Party. What do they say about this concept?
Yeah, so when I reached out to Democrats, the Utah Democratic Party, they declined to really comment on party switching, party raiding, but you know, they reminded me that, you know, they are they're considered what's an open tent party. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when I spoke to the Utah Republican Party, they said that party switching or what they deem party raiding is concerning, that it could impact even smaller races where 1, 2, 3 votes matter.
You mentioned that yesterday, March 31st, was the deadline for, I mean, because of that law, was the deadline to change your registration. I guess the question is, do we know how many people yet have done this time around?
I have not looked it up, but it's something that I'm keeping an eye on.
Okay. It's just there's something kind of amusing about it, but also a little bit tragic when you think about it. I'm going to bring Robert Gerke, the news columnist, in on this, because, you know, the parties are supposedly about certain sets of ideals and beliefs, but ultimately, you know, the parties themselves are just these labels. Robert Gerke, what do you think of this tactic?
Well, I mean, I think you're right that the parties are supposed to represent ideals, but also the voters are supposed to pick among those ideals. And I think, you know, giving more voters more of a say in more contests makes a lot of sense. I don't think it's a problem. And you know, to the point that the Republican Party was making about this potentially making a difference in some of the races. Well, yeah, of course, that's kind of the point. We do have this phenomenon in Utah where, and I need to double check this data, but the number I saw was roughly a third of the races at the state legislative level this coming year, the Democrats didn't field a candidate. So the only opportunity that voters have to, you know, express their opinion or express their preference in these races is in that primary. And we have a contested Senate race with Senator Mike Lee seeking re-election and being challenged by former Rep. Becky Edwards and Allie Isom. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you want to have a say in the outcome of that, the only way you can do it is to have changed your vote or changed your registration. I changed my registration 2 years ago, and Kim mentioned the contested gubernatorial race, because again, common sense would indicate that the winner of that nomination was going to be the next governor of the state of Utah, and that's how it turned out. That's how it usually turns out. So, you know, I think I think strategically it makes perfect sense. And you know, if Democrats want to close their primaries, I suppose that's something they could do. I think that would be detrimental to themselves as a party and to the process. But frankly, I think the Republican Party should have open primaries. And then, you know, they are the big race in town when they have those primaries. So let's let people express their opinions and pick their leaders.
I have spoken to some Democrats who think that it weakens their party. I mean, that it will erode the power of the opposition here in Utah. Is that a fair argument, Robert? And then actually, you know, I want to ask you a second thing, too. So that has to do with the idea that Democrats aren't fielding candidates in a number of races. And I guess the question I have there is, why not?
Yeah, I can't see how it would weaken the party. I mean, if you had somebody who was a real active, engaged Democrat who was organizing and then switched to Republican, switched the registration to Republican and stopped organizing for Democrats, that would be one thing. I think what hinders the Democratic Party is the second point you were getting to, is that they don't field candidates and they're not competitive in a lot of these elections. Part of that is the gerrymandering that goes on. I mean, we have seen roughly, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but fewer than about 5% of of general elections are contested, are close, are within 5 percentage points at the end. So those are races that are competitive, right? Mm-hmm. Most of the rest are blowouts, and a lot of them don't have candidates running in opposition at all. So, you know, I think that's bad for democracy, and I think that's a result of the gerrymandering that has gone on in this state and has gotten worse in this past cycle.
Democrats, though, used to be competitive here in the state of Utah. I mean, to a certain extent, for statewide office, even, you know, obviously in Congress, we had there was representation for Democrats there.
That's probably a larger conversation for another show. But I think that, you know, I think we have seen over the years that the National Party is not resonated. The message of the National Democratic Party has not resonated with Republican voters or conservative independent voters. And people and the state party has not done a good enough job of separating itself or distinguishing itself from that national message. And so when you do see Democrats who are successful, they're Democrats in the mold of a Jim Matheson or Ben McAdams who have, you know, managed to carve out an identity independent of the party. And so, you know, but the other point you or the other question you asked was why do Democrats have a hard time fielding candidates? And I think that's just because it's such a steep uphill climb and running for office is not easy. And you don't want to invest your time and energy and money when your, you know, chances of success are so slim. So, you know, we all have better things to do than, you know, tilt at windmills. So, yeah, it's hard. It's hard for Democrats to field a candidate. So given that, I think you have this situation where if the Republican primary is the only choice you have, then I think it makes sense to register as a Republican so you can vote in that election and have a voice, at least somewhat of a voice.
Kim, you know, I mentioned those Democrats who expressed concern about the sort of weakening of the party, but the Democratic Party here in Utah had basically no comment. I mean, that it wasn't we give you our blessing to go and do this, but we're not going to comment on whether or not it's a good idea.
I mean, it makes sense. You know, to an extent, you know, I don't think the Democratic Party wants to lose voters. Mm-hmm. So I could see why, you know, they didn't want to comment on this tactic in particular or advocate for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the background, as Robert pointed out, was the, you know, for example, the upcoming Senate race and people wanting to have a voice earlier on than when it comes to November. And there seems to be, as Robert put it, a tendency towards blowout elections. It's really interesting reporting, and I guess we'll see what happens. And I'll come back to you, Kim, at some point with a question about the data on what we saw in terms of people doing this party, quote unquote, party raiding. But thanks for your reporting on it.
I think we'll probably see. I don't think we have the numbers yet since the deadline was just yesterday. So probably sometime next week we'll be able to see how many people, you know, registered as Republicans.
Fantastic. You know, just on this sort of same topic, kind of on the same topic, because it's why Democrats and independents are doing this in the primaries. Brian Schott covered the Davis County Republican Convention, and which pointed to, that lurch to the right in the Republican Party that these party raiders are citing in making their maneuver over, especially in the primary races and in convention. And Robert, is there anything to say about what happened at Davis in Davis County? Brian Schott reported on a longstanding Republican representative, Stephen Handy, losing his bid to run for his seat. Just as one example.
This is actually, we'll preview my column for the weekend, but this is what I wrote about this week, because I think it's a pretty distressing omen when you see moderate Republicans, and it wasn't just Steve Handy. You had Melissa Garth Ballard. You had Ray Ward, both forced to primaries. Ward, a doctor and a, you know, moderate legislator, would have been eliminated had he not gathered signatures. Senator Jerry Stevenson, who was the co-chair of the Senate Budget Committee, he was forced to a primary. All of these by people who are considerably more conservative. I would even call them radical. And so what we're seeing is sort of a hallmark of the a longtime hallmark of the convention system is that the people who are most strident are the ones who get involved and involve themselves in the nomination process. And so you're seeing moderate candidates struggle. And I think part of this, too, is that last time we saw a big ultra-right surge was after the 2008 election when Democrats took control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. We saw the Tea Party rise. And so this is kind of a Tea Party 2.0 phenomenon. And I think a lot of legislators should be worried. I think another person who should be worried, frankly, is Congressman John Curtis. He finished fifth in the convention the first time he ran. He against Chris Herod, who was the one who the delegates wanted. This time, Herod's running again, and Representative Curtis didn't gather signatures. And I think if we see anything like what we saw in the Davis County Convention, Representative Curtis could be in a little bit of trouble.
It's interesting, and Brian's story is fascinating, too, and talks about the sort of rhetoric being used at the Davis County Convention. I encourage people to check it out because it's sort of a fascinating depiction of what has to be done in convention to convince delegates.
Everybody has to move hard to the right. You know, they were worried about the transgender athletes bill. They were worried about critical race theory. They were worried about election fraud. I mean, you know, just sort of this litany of these manufactured, concocted issues that you know, candidates have to deal with and have to make them, you know, and the way they have to kind of contort their bodies or contort their messages to appeal to these is really these folks is really interesting.
Kim, wasn't that something that people who were doing the party rating were specifically sort of? I mean, I mentioned Mr. Warburton. I can't remember his first name, Trevor, but were there other examples of people who had that same sort of concern about the, you know, what Brian Schott referred to as the quote-unquote lurch to the right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the voters that I talked to, all three, were talking about how they were really concerned with the Republican Party, you know, moving so much to the right. They were concerned with extremism. And, you know, they said that they had to take this drastic measure in order to make the candidates a little more to the middle.
Do you know if any, just for them, was it temporary? Are they switching parties and then going back after the primary?
Yeah, so when I talked to Trevor, he said that as soon as the primaries were over, he was going to switch back to an unaffiliated voter. I did speak to another unaffiliated voter who said that they had switched in 2020 for the governor's race and that they were just going to plan to stay Republican, even though they don't believe in Republican values.
Mm, wow, it's a bizarre and interesting sort of tactic. I guess it's what Robert Gerke says. It's a
strategic reality in this political landscape that we live in.
Okay, I kind of want to stay in this general sphere a little bit after we take a quick break on the show, but right now we should head to a break. There's more ahead. On Behind the Headlines, including a bit more in politics, and then the story of a Utah dancer who came forward with her own story of harassment, prompting a flood of Me Too statements from other dancers. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in 2 minutes' time.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Kim Bohorquez and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up. And you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW, although actually I've got to bring that up. Well, I said before the break that I wanted to stay in the same general, you know, ambit. We were talking about Representative Stephen Handy losing his bid to run for re-election in the Davis County Republican Convention. And Robert Gerke, this week you wrote about a Republican who could meet a similar fate, you say, because of the stance that he took last week. This is Senator Daniel Thatcher. He took that stance last Friday after this show had aired. And anyway, you had some laudatory things to say about the stance that he took in a column, but you say again that he might lose his seat as a result. Tell us, can you just remind us what this is all about?
Yeah, I mean, what this goes to the House Bill 11, which was the bill that banned transgender girls from competing in high school girls' sports. As you'll recall from last week, the legislature passed this bill in the 11th hour of the session, just in the last closing hours of the session, and the governor said he was going to veto it. He did, and the legislature then was able to flip enough votes to get support for overriding the veto. So last Friday, the legislature met in this veto override session, and most of the Republicans, all but one of the all but two of the Republicans, I'm sorry, flipped to support the veto override. Thatcher was in a predicament because he's been redistricted into a substantially new district. It's much more conservative district than he's had before. And he's got opponents. He didn't gather signatures, so this is the convention when it comes up is going to be, you know, sort of his make or break moment. And so it would have been real easy for him to vote, you know, toe the line, vote for the veto override, and maybe save his political career. But instead, you know, he gave this very impassioned speech on the floor about why he wasn't going to vote for the override. And he said that he thought the bill was unconstitutional. He thought it was going to cost taxpayers an awful lot of money. He thought it was going to harm transgender kids. He thought it was going to submit girls to, you know, these female athletes to undue scrutiny of their bodies.
He also described it as political theater.
And he said as political theater because courts are going to block it from taking effect as soon as there's a legal challenge. They were all doing it, in his eyes, for their reelection bids, you know, with an eye toward the reelection bids. And so he stood his ground. And I think it's going to probably end up costing him. But I thought what was remarkable about it is we don't see enough displays of political courage. You know, he was willing to, you know, recognizing that this might doom his political career, he was not willing to flip. And he said he was given advice by a former Senate president once that, you know, once you vote against your principles, you can't go back. And so he was just unwilling to do that. And had he gone, you know, his vote didn't make a difference. It was going to, they had the votes to override the veto anyway. But even though his vote didn't make a difference, he took a stand on principle and did not vote for the override.
And he does, as you said, have a primary challenger.
He's got three primary challengers, all of them very conservative, and the convention challengers. We'll see if they go to a primary.
Right.
And as I mentioned, this is a significantly new district that he's been drawn into. He used to be Tooele Magna in part of West Valley, and now he's like Harriman and Bluffdale and with a little sliver of Magna and Tooele. So, changed significantly.
He talked about during his speech, he said that he was going to have to go to delegates and explain his vote. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be willing to listen, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, he said that the delegates he's talked to are more passionate about this than anything he's seen before. It's hard to say. I mean, Representative Handy, who we mentioned before, lost at the convention, had voted for the bill when it was a commission to, you know, decide which girls can play and which ones can't. He voted against the ban that last night because he said it was a bad process. It was pulled on him in the last minute, and he didn't like the process and he didn't like the lack of funding. He did end up voting for the veto override, but it obviously didn't do him any good when he got to the convention. So it remains to be seen, I guess, how Thatcher's delegates are going to react. But I think he's in real significant trouble. And I think if I had to bet, he's got to get 40% of the delegate vote to get to a primary. And if he gets to a primary, I think maybe he has a shot. But getting 40% of the delegate vote in that crowded field is going to be hard.
I guess, I wanted to clarify that for Representative Handy, that he voted against the bill that bans transgender girls from participating in girls' school sports.
Yeah.
And then he, on the veto override, he voted for the veto override to get
right,
rid of okay,
right, little... right. He voted for the bill that would have created a commission.
Yeah.
He voted against a total ban. And then when they came back to override the governor's veto and impose the ban, he voted for that because he felt like that they had addressed the issue of the funding the lawsuit, because there were concerns that the Utah High School Athletics Association was going to be bankrupted by a lawsuit, and the legislature hadn't done anything to protect them from that. So when they came back into the special session, they allocated about $500,000 in taxpayer money to defend the High School Activities Association from that litigation.
And then you mentioned that there was, either of you, I think, could answer this question, that there was one other Republican who voted along the lines of Senator Thatcher to say no to the veto override.
In the Senate, it was Thatcher and Wyler were the two Republicans. All of the Democrats voted against the override.
Todd Wyler. Is he vulnerable as a result of that vote?
He's not up until for another 2 years, but I think he probably should be looking over his shoulder. He didn't make a statement or a production of his vote. Over in the House side, it was, I believe, Representative Spendlove and Representative Winder were the two Republicans who did not vote for the override. Representative Winder is not running for re-election. I believe Representative Spendlove doesn't have a challenger. And then, of course, all of the Democrats voted against the override.
Kim, HB11, this is something you covered at the session, I think, as well. Robert's talking about the legal challenge that is bound to come. And as a result of that legal challenge, assuming that this is struck down, what happens, if you can answer that?
If the ban is struck down in court, that would make it so that a commission goes into effect. This commission will have people appointed by the governor and by legislative leaders, and they will evaluate which transgender athletes are able to participate in school sports. It would not apply to private schools, however.
Okay, and the expectation is that it will be struck down, Robert. This is what Senator Thatcher was talking about. During his as you called it, stance.
And Senator Bramble, the Senate sponsor, Senator McKay, and Senator Adams, all of them say that they fully expect this to be enjoined by the courts while there's litigation pending, and then we'll see how the litigation goes. 11 other states are already litigating this issue, so they're in the pipeline ahead of us, I guess you should say.
Okay. It's interesting because it's an issue that I think motivates voters, and what that means for the future, I don't know. It can be used as a political tool that way as a result. But unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We will see. We will follow what happens in the courts and beyond. But for right now, we do need to turn to our final segment to save time for a recorded segment that is separate from that. So Underplayed Stories of the Week is this segment. And Kim Bohorquez, do you have a pick ready for Underplayed Story?
Yes. If you couldn't tell, I'm Latina.
Yes.
And my colleague, Julie Jagg, she wrote this really interesting story about how Ski Utah has formed an initiative to get more diverse skiers on the slopes.
Yeah.
She also found that, currently 1 in 9 skiers identify as non-white.
Wow.
Clearly the industry has a problem with diversifying its customers. So I'm really excited to see that progress, and I really recommend people to read it.
Awesome. Julie Jagg's story at sltrip.com. Kim, I got to ask, are you a skier?
No.
Me either.
But would you like to be?
I would love to be. Right.
Yeah.
So this program might change it.
Yeah. All right. Okay, sltrip.com to check out Julie Jagg's story on that. Thanks for your pick, Kim. Robert Gerke, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Mine was prominently played, I guess, but I think it's worth getting some attention. Bethany Rogers and Aaron Alberti did a story yesterday about flaws and shortcomings and real deficiencies in the Test Utah program that were cited by federal regulators earlier this month, including tests that were left out, commingled, ignored, damaged. It was pretty alarming, the sort of sloppiness that went on there. I hope I can say this. I'm going to say this. They're both going to be leaving us, and I think as a farewell story, it was a terrific piece of journalism that people should look at.
Oh wow, you broke some news for me there. That's tough to hear, but kudos to them on the story. I mean, one of the quotes that was a takeaway for me was the idea that health, whoever was doing the audit said this was damaging to public health.
Imminent threat to public health and safety. The response, frankly, from the state and from the Test Utah was pretty disappointing, because we shouldn't have to, if there are those kinds of imminent threats to public safety, we shouldn't have to be finding out about it through open records requests and tenacious journalism. It should be a little bit more transparency, it seems to me.
All right, Robert Gerke with a great pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. I'm going to go with Sage Miller's amazing piece on high school debaters. It's a multimedia piece that includes some great video and photographs, even GIFs? What do you guys say?
GIFs.
Okay.
Yeah.
You all say. Trent Nelson and Rachel Rydalsh have those embedded in the story. But high school kids debating what to do about our water future, and kind of brilliantly, you can check it out and all of the rest of what we've been talking about today over at sltrib.com. And with that, I will say goodbye to my two in-studio guests. Robert Gerke is news columnist with the Tribune, and thanks for being here again, Robert.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. Have a good weekend.
And Kim Bohorquez is State Watch reporter with the Trib. Thanks for being here, Kim.
Thank you.
Yeah. We will take another quick break in the show, and then when we come back, we will turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune culture reporter Palak Jaiswal. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. And now on the show, we're going to turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune culture reporter Palak Jaiswal. And to kick things off, I asked her about the Utah dancer who came forward with a story of harassment by a well-known choreographer here in town, and then had her story echoed back to her by hundreds of others. Take a listen. Palak Jaiswal, Tribune culture reporter, thank you very much for making time for this. I appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for having me.
A couple of stories of yours that I want to tackle this week. First off, let's talk about a Utah dancer. This is Utah dancer Sibley Wozmak. You wrote about her experience this week, an interaction that she had with a well-regarded choreographer here in Salt Lake City, and her coming forward with that experience. You know, rather than my going any further into this, I'm wondering if you can just give us the outline of the story that Sibley Wozmak recounted.
Absolutely. So Sibley Wozmak is a freelance dancer in the Salt Lake area, mm-hmm. which means she is not associated with any given company that puts on dance productions in Utah. And she was able to connect with this choreographer via Instagram DM. She was looking to be cast in some of the pieces this choreographer did and looking to connect professionally. And they were talking, and the exchange took a turn and became sexually explicit. Part of that sexually explicit content included just asking for inappropriate content and messages like that. And you know, Sibley, she decided to shut down the conversation. She made it very clear that she wanted it to be professional, but she felt that she had a duty to share that story with the wider dance community, especially as a freelance dancer. They're kind of, in a way, at the mercy of choreographers to be put in pieces and get, you know, their career further. And so when she decided to share her story, she did so with screenshots of the exchange. And she just made a post, and she tagged a bunch of reputable dance organizations in the region, including some where this individual had been employed and had done pieces with. She was not expecting to hear from anyone. She heard from 250 women, individuals really, who had similar experiences, some dating as far back as 10 years with the same individual.
Wow. I mean, you spoke with one of the 250 dancers, you know, or individuals who came forward, who relayed an experience. And I'll just, as a warning, I'll say that it's a little bit explicit. And this is a dancer who was at the University of Utah's School of Dance, who was approached by this choreographer a few years ago, I guess. This dancer's name is Courtney Collins. Can you tell us what she told you?
Yes, definitely. So Courtney Collins was indeed a student at the University of Utah. She was a freshman when she interacted with this choreographer. She was 19 years old. She, along with some other students, were put into a senior student piece, and this is how she was able to meet this choreographer. They had exchanged phone numbers a lot of the dancers, you know, at the U's dance program, dancers in the Utah area, they're looking to go to these companies post-graduation. So they're looking to make connections and network. And so when they exchanged phone numbers, he also added her to his Snapchat contacts. They never Snapchatted, and she was eventually cast in a show at an organization this man worked at. And from there, they had never Snapchatted. Halfway through the show's rehearsals, the choreographer sent a video of himself nude, watching pornographic content and masturbating. Courtney was 19. She recalls feeling so violated, and she recalls calling her mother and sobbing. And the very next day, she pulled out of the show. She didn't even go to see the choreographer in person. She did it over social media. And then he blocked her on social media.
I'll say also, just because I know it's in your reporting that the Tribune, and I'm assuming this is you, Palak, spoke with Courtney's mother. She confirmed that Courtney reported this at the time to her. I mean, it's sort of like a corroborating detail that because Snapchat, I think, just to explain to listeners who may not be familiar, there was this period of time where, you know, things would just vanish. You couldn't capture what had happened. I mean, I guess you could do screenshots or whatever, but it would go away. Anyway, that's a side note. But for a time, this experience that she had basically chased her, the student, out of dance altogether, right? At least here in the state of Utah. Is that correct?
Yes, she, for a number of reasons, this one included, decided to drop her major in the dance program and change entirely. She now lives somewhere else, and she is involved in the commercial dance world there. But even then, she feels nervous about being back involved in the dance world. And, you know, you bring up a really good point with Snapchat. Sibley was able to screenshot these Instagram DMs because they stay there. You know, 10 years ago, Snapchat videos didn't stay there. And when you aren't expecting to see something like that, you don't have the reflexes to screenshot it. And so a lot of these women, from what we found in our reporting, is just that they felt like they had no proof and they couldn't come forward because of the mediums used. And I think something important in this story is that a lot of people think of sexual harassment in a traditional sense, you know, being catcalled on the sidewalk. It's changing as our technology changes, and these platforms are being used to harass people of all types.
Yeah. There are other stories, as you pointed out, the a number of people who came forward and expressed that they had similar experiences to Sibley. A number of people didn't want to go public with them, I think, for that exact reason that you brought up, which was that they didn't feel like they had proof. Some people didn't want to jeopardize their future with a reputable choreographer. The choreographer himself, did he respond to your reporting or to these allegations? I know that the Tribune reached out to him.
He did not respond. We reached out a few times, and he responded and said that his lawyer had advised him not to respond.
Okay. A couple of well-known dance companies here in Utah, and well-known is sort of an understatement, but dance companies here in Utah that this choreographer had been affiliated with took action as a result of what this freelance dancer shared on her Instagram page. Can you tell us about the action that they took?
Absolutely. So the individual was involved with a couple of dance companies here in Utah, particularly Repertory Dance Theater and Ballet West. In Sibley's original post in the caption, she had tagged all of these organizations. All of them responded either in the comments or by taking action. Ballet West announced that it had placed him on a leave of absence, also pending an investigation, which is similar to what RDT did. They had announced that they had suspended a principal dancer and choreographer pending an investigation. And the following Monday after Sibley's post, RDT shared a statement that they had terminated the man's contract and severed any other future association with them. They said in the statement, they are not a company that condones or tolerates inappropriate behavior.
Wow. You know, just before we wrap up here on this story, I noticed that the Salt Lake Tribune doesn't name this choreographer in the story. And I'm wondering if, Palak, you can talk about how and why that decision was made. Or, can you explain just why the Tribune doesn't do that?
Yes. So because there are no criminal or civil charges filed against this individual, the Tribune has decided not to name him. And this is a policy that was put into place long before I started.
Understood. Well, it's a troubling story, and you can find it at sltrib.com. And Palak, thank you for your reporting on this. There's much more in the story that I hope listeners will check out. But just in the interest of time, I'd like to turn to another story that you reported on this week. And this one is about hair discrimination, about salons and barbers in the state of Utah, and about something called the Crown Act. And, you know, your story starts with an 11-year-old girl, a black girl named Lexi, sitting in a stylist chair, and then it kind of expands out from there. It's hard to know where to begin here. Maybe for people who, for whatever reason, aren't aware of this, can you define the term hair discrimination and the extent of the problem here in Utah? It's a huge overarching question, but maybe take a stab at that.
Definitely. So hair discrimination can be defined as discrimination that's based on an individual's texture or style of hair. And in context with my story, I particularly talk about black hair. You mentioned the Crown Act. So the Crown Act is a piece of legislation that is nationwide that basically prohibits this discrimination based on an individual's texture or hairstyle. This type of discrimination can happen in work when people are applying for jobs. It can be used for when they're being fired. It can happen in schools for young children like Lexi. Actually, one of the startling statistics from my reporting is a 2021 nationwide survey, which was commissioned by Dove, the soap and skincare brand, that found that 100% of Black girls in majority white elementary schools reported experiencing hair discrimination or, you know, being treated differently because of their hair by the age of 10 years old. Lexi's 11. That's the same age group.
Yeah. I mean, one aspect of your reporting talks about the beauty industry, the cosmetology industry in the state of Utah. And for any Black individual here in our state, finding a barber or a stylist who is skilled at working with their hair can be really difficult. And that's not the same as hair discrimination, but it's just one of the sort of trials and travails of being Black in the state of Utah. Can you talk about, you know, how big of a problem finding somebody who knows how to deal with this hair type is in the state of Utah?
Absolutely. So for Utah's growing Black population, the experience of having their hair done isn't just a matter of looking good. It's about a personal identity. And so I started looking into this and I came across a nonprofit organization called Utah Beauty Project. Their president is Devin Johnson Kramer, and they had been going to put on a talk at the University of Utah about critical race theory in hair. And I thought that was very interesting. And through that, I was able to meet Imani Powell, who is the stylist in the story. She is the owner of Essence of Ebony, and she is one of 19 Black hair salons and barbershops in the state, according to the Utah Black Chamber, that has a directory of Black businesses. There may be more, but this is what we found. And part of my conversation with Devin and Imani was the schooling we have in Utah for the cosmetology licenses. Devin called the beauty industry the most segregated industry in America. And she also describes the cosmetology schools in Utah as built for white straight hair. And so the critical race theory part of it comes in because stylists aren't taught how to deal with all types of hair in school. If they want to learn about different types of hair, like Black people's hair, they're expected to explore that niche on their own. And so it's an issue that starts in education and kind of transfigures into things that are happening in legislature, in helping people feel accepted.
Yeah. And what's not taught in schools is then reflected in the greater society as a result. The fix here, I guess, is to have it taught in schools. And then there's also, you reached out to the state licensing department, I know, for your story. You know, there's also what the state actually requires or, again, doesn't require when it comes to getting licensed. And actually, can you tell us what state licensing says about this?
Yeah, so we spoke to a spokesperson for the Utah Department of Commerce, and they told us that the state uses a licensing test for hairstylists from a national testing provider. So this might not just be a Utah problem. This might be a national problem. The only type of kind of inclusivity learning that stylists in Utah go through, according to Johnson Kramer, is learning about chemical relaxers, which basically are products that help uncurl Black people's natural hair texture.
Hmm. Right. There's a lot more to your story, including some really just fascinating conversations with people who find their place in the stylist chair for people who actually know how to deal with Black hair. But just going back to the 11-year-old Lexi in that salon chair, having the skills of someone like Imani Powell working on her hair, it was pretty significant. Lexi's mom talked about there being a kind of before and after. Can you sort of elaborate on that, Palak?
Yeah, so Lexi had seen a number of different hairstylists and barbers in Utah, some of them Black, some of them white, but she's never really felt good about her hair until she started meeting Imani. And part of what was interesting about my reporting about Imani's salon is she teaches her clients how to take care of their hair on their own time. And that's something that is something that we don't really think about, you know, unless you're forced to think about that kind of stuff. You know, Black hair requires different products. It requires different time and different care to maintain it, really. And so when they found Imani, Lexi's mom, Kelly, was just talking about how every time they go to see her, you know, if she's sitting in the chair for 8 hours, for 10 hours, it's fine because they walk out after and she has the biggest smile on her face. And you can tell that she feels confident in herself. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's really an interesting story, and I hope people will check it out. Palak, is there anything that we're missing from the story that you'd really like to convey that is a detail that for some reason, one reason or another, we didn't get to?
One thing that I thought was really interesting is Imani is, when she was going through her school experience here in Utah, she grew up on the East Coast in New Jersey, and both of her parents are Black, and they taught, you know, Black hairstyles in an East Coast area where there are a lot of ethnic neighborhoods. We don't have that in Utah. And so when she came here to Utah and went to one of the cosmetology schools here, she didn't learn anything about Black hair, even though she had a Black teacher who didn't know anything about Black hair because she had gone through the same cosmetology process that Imani was going through currently. And so she was asked to teach her fellow students about how to deal with Black hair while she was learning on her own time. And so now that she has Essence of Ebony, she really has taken to creating educational experiences like that. She has a natural hair certificate program that she's going to be teaching in early April. And these are education programs that are not just geared towards Black people and how to take care of your hair on your own time, but also to all types of people who want to learn, who may have that gap in their education that they really want to fill out. And, you know, she had a really important quote in the story that I think summarizes it really well. You know, the Black experience has been specifically taken out of education since the beginning of this country. We have to work really hard to make sure that people are going to get into this business are very aware of what it actually means to be able to style someone that is person of color or Black.
Wow. Palak Jaiswal, Salt Lake Tribune culture reporter. It's really fascinating reporting, and we appreciate your taking the time to explain it to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, Palak Jaiswal writes about culture for the Salt Lake Tribune. This week, she also wrote about Thierry Fisher's last season at the Utah Symphony, about the U.S. Department of Labor accusing South Salt Lake's Chinatown supermarket of obstructing an investigation into that store's labor practices. Check those out. She's also been hosting the Tribune's Daily Buzz podcast, which you should subscribe to if you don't already. It's a daily dip into Utah news. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast. Behind the Headlines is our Friday morning deep dive into what happened this week in Utah. And that does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.